So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to our second installment in 5782-2022, our series on Megillas Esther, the Book of Esther. And let's do a little chazara. Let's catch everybody up. So we began with a little bit of a probe into the mind of a king. Achashverosh, the new king, had no royal blood. He was not regal of nature. He had ascended to the throne. We are told Amolech. He was the one who forced himself as the king. And therefore, that's a big issue. Because all throughout the book, throughout the Megillah, he's very sensitive to how people view him in light of the fact that he's not true nobility. He and his wife, Queen Vashti, plan out a new world. We mentioned last week that prior to the events of our story, that the capital city had never been in Shushan, but had been elsewhere under the great-grandfather King Nebuchadnezzar, grandfather of Vashti, evil Merodach, father of Queen Vashti, the evil Belshazzar, and finally there was Vashti. So they moved the palace to a new location, kind of like a new beginning. You know how when we came from the UK to America, everything became new. New York, new, right? All the states, the founding states usually have that word new to separate themselves from the United Kingdom. So the same thing here. Vashti and Achashverosh were partners in crime, and they wanted to invent a new world. And so at the end of a couple of years of royalty, of leadership, he assembled the masses, the 127 provinces and states that he ruled over, that he had inherited from the Babylonian and Persian Empire. And he threw this enormous party to solidify his place among the people. For 180 days, the party was glorious. And before everyone went home, he let 7 days of partying continue to the best and brightest. Wine was served of the greatest vintage. The wine, we said, had to be 1 year older than the individual drinking the wine. It's kind of significant, right? You invite, you invite Abraham to the party, you got to have a 176-year-old bottle of very fine wine. So it's quite impressive. And there was no coercion. And we pointed out that the Jews were the target, unknowingly to the Jews, of this party. That the king Achashverosh made a big deal about dressing Bilvush in the garments, the 8 unique vestments that were worn by the high priest, the Kohen Gadol, in temple times. And how did he come by these kelim, by these vestments that were used for the party? Because, of course, his great-grandfather-in-law, old King Nebuchadnezzar, had pilfered them from the temple when he destroyed the temple in the year 592 before the Common Era. So they found their way to Babylonia. He felt assured that it was okay to dress and not receive God's wrath. Now, Belshazzar had tried the same thing. Belshazzar died that night, didn't make it till morning. Because God was not happy, not impressed that you're bringing out the big de kahuna, the priest's unique vestments that he wore in the temple in service of God. And you schmutzy king, schmutz is a good Yiddish word for like a lowlife, the schmutzy king is going to bring out God's kelim? I see Rina smiling. I'm not sure the exact translation of schmutz, but I know it is not a four-letter word. Schmutz. Schmutz is like garbage or dirty.
That's what I put.
Right?
Clean off the soup at the top.
Here, let me unmute you for a second, Rina. Just give me 1 second, because she's going to give us the actual translation. 1 second. Okay, you can unmute yourself now. You can unmute yourself. There you are. So
schmutz is dirt.
Dirt.
Schmutz means dirt.
Like a grubby king, a schmutzy king.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you very much. I once used another word, which I will not use in company tonight or ever. It also starts with the SH sound. And I just thought it meant like schmutz. And my father, Zatzal, gave me such a zetz. You know, he just started, it just poked me a little bit and said, David, do you know what that word means? It refers to a male body part. So from then on, I never ventured into the realm of Yiddish unless I was assured that it wasn't a male or female body part. Exactly. A little embarrassing it was. I was about 10 years old. So I'm going to mute you again, or you can mute yourself, Rina. That would be great.
Okay,
thank you.
My whole screen went black. I don't know what I did.
Oh, don't worry about it. Can you see us now?
I can see you, but you're very muted, like.
That shouldn't.
I must have touched something.
Oh, okay. I'm not sure. I'm going to mute you again, though, okay?
Okay. Okay.
Thank you. You should be okay. So, the schmutzy king, now that we're satisfied that it's safe for me to use the word and not get in trouble, that I won't get censored or canceled for this, right? Right? Okay. The schmutzy king puts on the...
The network's taking your program.
They might right now. As we speak, Joe Rogan's here and Deva Kaplan's here, and we're both being taken down, right? As we speak. They're eliminating all my Torah classes from Spotify. I'm gone. I'm done. All right. So what happens? Achashverosh, we said last week, we learned that he made a whole calculation that it was 70 years since the fall of Jerusalem and that it was safe because God wasn't saving the Jews anymore. And because God hadn't redeemed the Jews and the prophecy of the Bible had been 70 years and then the Jews would be redeemed to go back to Israel, rebuild the temple, it hadn't happened. Obviously what? God was angry with the Jews still, so it was safe to bring out the priestly garments. He made a miscalculation because he calculated the fall of Jerusalem as opposed to the destruction of Jerusalem, the burning of the temple, etc. So he was a little off in his mathematical equation. Okay, be that as it may, seventh day of the party, he invites Queen Vashti to appear before him wearing the crown of the queen, but nothing else, to show off her beauty. Everyone in the room are there all drunk. They're all imbibing in this delicious fortified wine, and they have a discussion about beauty in the Persian women. According to Ahasuerus, she hypes them as the best. And of course, Vashti is not a modest young lady. She's waiting to show off her beauty. She doesn't mind. So he summons her very publicly. But when Vashti's about to come, and here's what I'm going to talk about, everybody, as a little child, you may have learned that the angel Gabriel came, and he either gave an acne one-time acne plague to poor Vashti, who was struck suddenly with acne and was embarrassed, or he pinned a tail on her, like an animal. Either way, she looks in the mirror, and after saying, mirror, mirror on the wall, who's the finest of them all, the mirror cracks and just self-destructs, so she understands it's not her. So it's not enough that she doesn't go at the behest of her husband, the king. She sends a letter back, basically embarrassing him, shaming him publicly. You, my dear king, have the chutzpah, I'm sure she used that word. You have the audacity to pick on me, great-granddaughter of King Nebuchadnezzar, daughter of Belshazzar, who are real nobility, and you embarrass me and shame me to bring me in front of you and your drunk friends to show me off? Like what? If you had been alive, she goes on to say, and this must have really struck a chord with Ahasuerus, if you were alive in the time of my great-grandfather Nebuchadnezzar, he wouldn't have hired you to clean out the manure in the barn. And this message is delivered to Ahasuerus, who is phenomenally drunk. Now, we know that when a person is drunk, you ask people who go to Hanukkah or Xmas parties, sometimes when the wine comes in, the secrets are spilled. Not a good thing. So the king reacts very viscerally, right? What do I do with the queen? He wants her head on a plate. He wants her dead and deader. He wants her sleeping with the fish. But everyone around him realizes that he's going to wake up tomorrow and there'll be no queen and the blame will be on us and not on him, because that's what kings do. So the message is delivered. He's irate. He asks the rabbis to come in and help him. The rabbis are very smart. They say, Your Royal Highness, we're not sure what to do, because they realize that if he kill her or don't kill her, we're going to be blamed. It'll be Jewish scapegoating. So they beg off. He asks his seven royal advisors. Six of them are smart enough to kind of, they mute themselves, kind of like tonight. And then the seventh one, Mimuchan, steps up and says, Your Royal Highness, the sin of the queen is not only on you, Your Royal Highness, and your monarchy. It falls on every man. Because how can any man tomorrow order his wife to cook him breakfast? She's going to say, make it yourself, dear. I heard that Vashti didn't show up at the behest of her husband, the king. I don't have to show up at your behest and do what you want. Make your own breakfast. Clean your own clothes. We're done here. There was no suffragette movement back in Persia back then. Women were not of equal status at that time. So Memuchan, the seventh advisor, we are identifying last week as Haman himself. And this is the rise of Haman. And how does he rise? Well, he rises because, number one, he's very smart. He's very astute. He knows how to read the king, to manipulate the king. But more than that, Haman convinces the king to go along with this plan to get rid of Vashti. Thereby, the king has to invest himself in Haman's vision of the empire. Otherwise, they both fall, which ultimately one of them does at the end of the story, but not the king. So what happens? They send out a letter. Not enough that Vashti is eliminated and done. She's sleeping with the fish somewhere in the it's the East River. That's where she is right this moment, right? Somewhere among the East River's occupancy from the 30s and 40s. I believe there's a lot of occupants who were given, you know, cement shoes at that time. So Vashti was taken away and summarily executed. And then a letter is sent out, a letter is dispatched. And the letter basically says, Your Royal Highness King Ahasuerus commands you that in the same way he has dominion over Queen Vashti and laid the law down to her, each of you men must be a man in his house and command respect from your wife. So the men and the women of the entire 127 kingdoms provinces are with bated breath waiting for this first communique that has never ever come in 3 years of his dominion. So they're waiting, and they look at this letter, and they think to themselves, oh, wait a minute. The king says we have to rule over our wives? I mean, like what? Of course we rule over our wives. What is he talking about? This was worthy of a royal dispatch of the Pony Express being taken from Shushan to let us know? So they all kind of scratch their heads in wonder, and they think, you know, I thought Ahasuerus was a smart guy. He's supposed to be such an astute politician. But to send out a letter with all this bravado, when it's a devar pashut, it's very simple that man rules over the woman, of course. This is Persia, right? It's like Saudi Arabia today, right? Women don't drive. There's no women's rights in Saudi Arabia. People just pretend that it's not true, but it's true, okay? So what happens? This is a critical part because this is the first and only letter that we know of that was sent out in years of Ahasuerus' reign. And we know of a second letter that was sent out many years later. And ironically, it was sent by the king and it was penned by the same author, Haman. And what was that letter all about? Be ready for the 13th day of the Jewish month of Adar next year. And on that day, exterminate the Jews. That's the only other letter that ever was sent. Now, why is it critical? Because in the absence of the first letter, the people might have said, oh my gosh, the king wants us to kill the Jews, we'll do it for nothing. We don't like those Jews. Let's not wait for next Adar. Let's just, tonight, let's have a nice little pogrom like they did in Poland, and let's kill the Jews. But they didn't do that because they thought, wait a minute, this is the same idiot who sent us that letter years ago about being a man over his wife? You know what? Let's wait because this guy is a little bit of a dimwit. And you know what? Maybe he'll change his mind before next year. It saved the Jews. It gave Esther and Mordecai the opportunity, the window of salvation, to go and beg for Ahasuerus to change his mind, right? So it's critical. Now comes the lovely part that I learned. Okay, you ready? This is really, really good stuff. I relayed the story, the children's story, to you. That Vashti either had the acne breakout or she had a tail pinned to her. Tail pinned to her. She grew a tail. So sometimes you'll buy like little children's books and stuff, you'll actually see Queen Vashti like with a tail, like an animal. Are we meant to take that literally? Or are the rabbis communicating to us in a code and we're supposed to decode what the Medrash says? So I'm going to decode it for you right now. You ready? Okay, listen to this. King Nebuchadnezzar, like Ahasuerus, was not of royal lineage. You know, normally, just ask Charles or any of the House of Windsor occupants, you get your kingship through mom and dad, and it goes all the way back and back and back.
Is this your codification or somebody else is just repeating it?
Oh, I'm going to quote it. It's from the Chafetz Chaim. I'm going to quote the Shem Omro in the name of the Chafetz Chaim. So listen to this. It's not mine. I wish it were. Kings usually are born into it. You're born into nobility, into royalty. Like Ahasuerus assumed the mantle of the king, same thing for Nebuchadnezzar. And remember, King Nebuchadnezzar, as they call him, is a real historical figure. He's not like some, you know, somewhere in a make-believe book. How did he become the king? I'm glad you asked. So At the time of the Babylonian sort of empire, when Nebuchadnezzar was rising up, he was a scribe. He was the official scribe of the king, Biladan. And the king in Israel, before the temple was destroyed, had its own king. They had a monarchy in Judah, the king of Yehuda. And his name was Chizkiyahu. Chizkiyahu was a very sick man. Deathbed sick. God healed him from his deathbed. In order to show the world that that was a miraculous thing, it was a nace. In addition to healing Chizkiyahu, the king of Judah, who was a really special person, God decided to compact the day. And instead of 24 hours, it went into 18 hours. And then all of a sudden, it started again with nighttime and morning. So it was an 18-hour day compressed from 24. An overt miracle. Word spread like wildfire. People were going crazy in cyberspace. They were tweeting and Facebooking everybody. And the world found out. All the way back in Babylonia, King Biladan, who again, the Babylonian Empire wasn't really at its zenith yet. It was still quiet. But he heard that, oh my gosh, Chizkiyahu, king of the Jews of Judah, was miraculously saved, and God publicized the miracle by contracting the day. Wow. And he wanted to offer him his joy and congratulations. So he said, scribes, come here. But Nebuchadnezzar, his chief scribe, wasn't there. So his second-in-command scribe came in, picked up the quill, yes, your royal highness, and he wrote a letter congratulating King Chizkiyahu on the miracle. So what did King Biladan of Babylonia write? He says, ready? To you, King Chizkiyahu, peace be upon Jerusalem, gratitude to the Jewish God. And then he went on to say how wonderful it is that God saved your life. Okay. Message is written. It's sent via Pony Express from King Biladan of Babylonia to King Chizkiyahu, the king of Judah. But as the letter is literally in the hands of the FedEx guy, and he's about to get on his horse, King Nebuchadnezzar comes back. And he's the chief scribe. He didn't know anything about the letter. He normally has some input into what should be written. He's the editor. But he wasn't there. So they tell him what he said. And he says, oh my gosh, you can't write that. You can't put God third when you're writing to the king of Judah. He says, you can't do that. It's got to read, praise to God, peace be upon Jerusalem, the great king, Chizkiyahu. That's the right order. You inverted it. So he runs out desperately, trying to flag down the FedEx guy before he leaves. Of course, you never successfully get those guys. He ran four strides before he realized, no, I'm not going to catch him. So the Talmud says that Gabriel, the angel who pinned the tail on Queen Vashti to make sure she didn't go to the party and that she would be killed, he stopped Nebuchadnezzar from running. So he made four strides and then he gave up. And the Talmud says, had he not given up, had he kept pursuing and was successful, no Jew would have been left in the world, would have been destroyed, all of the Jewish people. So what does that mean? You ready for this? Where's the tail? The tail's at the end of something, the end of a process. So on Rosh Hashanah, on the Jewish New Year, we very often will eat the head of a fish or we'll have something on our plate and we'll say we should be L'Rosh V'lo L'Zanav. We should be at the head of the year and not the tail, the end process of the year. So what the Midrash, according to the great Chafetz Chaim, is teaching us, believe it or what you want about Gabriel, but what it's showing us is the following, that had Nebuchadnezzar run more than four strides, then the Jews would have been successfully exterminated, but not in his time, in his great-granddaughter's time, Vashti. So you have Vashti, generation four, removed from her great-grandfather, King Nebuchadnezzar. So in other words, the four strides parallel the four generations of Nebuchadnezzar's nobility. His noble line stopped when Queen Vashti was killed by Ahasuerus. So therefore the tail, the metaphorical tail that was pinned by the angel on Vashti, was just a nice way of saying she was at an end. The noble line of King Nebuchadnezzar came to a tail, the end of the process. That's what it's a metaphor for. And think about it, but what does it really mean? Well, what if Vashti was not killed? Where does that leave Esther? Where does that leave the Jews? We're dead. If we don't have Esther in the palace, if she doesn't have the secret that she's a Jewess and has the moment to reveal all to Ahasuerus and undermine Haman, what does that leave the Jewish people? We're dead. So in other words, when the Talmud says that if Nebuchadnezzar's noble line had lasted more than four generations, the Jews would have died, it's basically referring directly to the fourth generation in the person of Queen Vashti. If Vashti stays as the queen, the Jews don't survive. So God is already planning four generations in advance, in the time of King Nebuchadnezzar, how to undermine Haman. And he's leaving the preparations there. It's just a way, an illustration of how the Medrash is showing that God knows everything, and he's divinely orchestrating even multiple generations in the future. And which is an amazing thing, because we know ourselves that when we look back retroactively at circumstances, in real time, they don't make sense. But backwards, yes. And this is God's promise to the Jewish people. He says, you know what? I cannot explain to you why bad things happen to good people. Because you as a human are limited in your exposure to truth and to reality. You can see now, the present, maybe a little bit of what's going on, although we live in a very confusing, upside down world. And you can study history and maybe know the past. You can't know the future. So because you are limited, as humanity limits your vision, your scope, only I, God, can see the past, the present, and the future as one, and it makes sense in my realm. It'll never make sense in your realm. So in other words, this is an illustration of how very often the little decisions that are made, sometimes they percolate for a generation or two, like a fine brandy, or one of Ahasuerus' fortified wines, or your morning cup of coffee. Hopefully it doesn't wait 4 years. And generations later, we see the fruits of God's sort of divine plan come to fruition. I'm going to share a similar thing with you in a few minutes, okay? That is amazing. Course,
there's something about how to be a person. Be the head of a lion rather than the tail
of a fox.
Yeah.
Correct.
Are the two connected?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Does one come from the other?
Well, I mean, there's a parallel metaphor. Yeah, absolutely. Beautiful. It also says, who is the wise person? Whoever sees the nolad, what is yet to happen. In other words, before we act, we're sort of trying to stop and say, wait a minute, what will the long-term ramifications be of this choice that I make? So again, it's interrelated. Beautiful. Thank you, Barry. Okay, ready? Let's do the second chapter. So Vashti is summarily executed. We never hear from her again. And now we understand what the story with the tail and what that really means. Okay. What happens to the king? So we're in Perek Beis in the second chapter. Okay, you ready? This is on page number 13, if you're with me here in person. After all this happened, when the anger of King Ahasuerus calmed down, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and how she had been punished. Then the king's young servants said to him, and this is where, and I'll just paraphrase the next part. This is the famous beauty contest. The king is sad. He's depressed. He's lonely. You need a queen. Let's have a pageant. Let's get all the young ladies from the 127 kingdoms to come. We'll have a big contest. And the winner will be anointed as queen after Vashti. So I'm going to blow away this little bit of image in your life. When you were little, how many girls dressed up as little Queen Esther's to go to the beauty pageant, right? I mean, we all did. In the age of...
I had only about two, but Neil had like...
Even the guys out there in today's day and age probably dressed up as Esther. That's another story. Okay, so what happens? This is not the beauty pageant of your imagination. It wasn't a beauty pageant. It was a state sanctified, and I have no other words for this, I'm sorry, rape fest. The women were taken against their will. The men would go and be dispatched from kingdom to kingdom, and yes, any fine, beautiful woman, whether she was married or not, it did not matter, was taken. And they were taken to the palace. They were farpitzed, nice little Yiddish term. They were given the finest oils and ointments and beauty and charms. For months, they were allowed to sort of get themselves ready for their night with the king. And then the king would have a night with them. And then, unless he specifically asked for them by name, they were thrown into his concubines, into the harem, never to be heard from again. Again, it's kind of deflating for the little Esther wannabes, right, that you're kind of like, so I'm sorry to say that, but that's the truth. You need to know the brutal truth of our story, because it's about emes, about truth. And it makes sense in a way. Think about it for a moment. Vashti had emasculated the king in a very profound way. Because when it says after these things, we're talking years. It took years for King Ahasuerus to get over what Vashti did to him. How she so profoundly undermined him, embarrassed him in front of the great royalty and nobility and the 127 kingdoms. It was a shanda for the king, and it took him a long time. He was depressed. He was down. He couldn't relate to a woman in a normal way. What, he's going to go out on a date? He's going to have small talk? He's not capable of that. The only thing he's capable of, essentially, is having, you know, a concubine girlfriend who he pays for, essentially, and then throws away at the end of the day so she can't talk about. In other words, if she's free to leave and not imprisoned in his harem, then she goes and compares notes with other women, and all of a sudden, you know, cyberspace is lighting up with Ahasuerus' deficiencies. But if she's basically a prisoner at the palace and cast into this harem, never to be heard from again, then it's safe. It's a safe non-relationship. And that is all Ahasuerus right now is capable of. So it's a little bit of a different spin that we're seeing right now on our story. Okay? And now on page 14, we come to a very important pasuk. Now you know it's an important verse because it's written in bold print. In fact, if you have the Haggadah that we're using, the youth series, it's not just in bold, it's in green, which is in keeping with the thematic element. So this is the part where we actually say this verse ahead of the one who's the Baal Kori, the Megillah reader, okay? So I'll read it in Hebrew. Ish Yehudi haya b'Shushan HaBira. There was a Jewish man in Shushan, the capital. Ushma Mardechai, and his name was Mardechai. Ben Yair, son of Yair. Ben Shimi, grandson of Shimi. Ben Kish, grandson of Kish, great-grandson of Kish. Ish Yimini, a man from the tribe of Benjamin. Let's stop for a moment. This verse is very famous because it introduces us to Mordechai, the head rabbi of Shushan, and then the next couple of verses are going to talk about his cousin, Esther, who was orphaned at a very, very young age. How do we know this? Because it says she never knew her mom and dad. In other words, she really never knew a mother and a father. Never. The poor young lady, Esther, had no parental contact, ever. So she's adopted, essentially, by Mordechai, her cousin. They are not, by the way, uncle and niece. A lot of people are under that impression. But you just read the text. They're related, but they're not uncle and niece. Chazal, though, our rabbis say that when Esther got older, she and Mordechai were actually wed. They were husband and wife. And that's a very critical part of the story. Okay. So let's talk about the identity of Mordechai. I want to share something with you now. We talked about, remember, the theme for tonight, of how in the time of Chizkiyahu, the king of Judah, that Nebuchadnezzar wanted to redact the letter, and how four generations later, his great-granddaughter Vashti was the end, the tail of his nobility, and how God sees all and plans all. It's right here also, in a magnificent way. So let me share this with you. So here's my question. There was an Ish Yehudi. So we're translating it here as a Jewish man. It's not a correct translation. There are 12 tribes of Israel, correct? There are 12 tribes of Israel. And the 12 tribes of Israel, especially before this moment, were very territorial. They had a unique identity. You may have heard of the lost tribes that we lost in the northern kingdom of Israel. Okay, that's a fact. But the tribes identified uniquely with the Bible and with who their great-great-grandfather was. So you have Reuven and Shimon and Levi and Judah, Yehuda, the fourth son. And it goes all the way down to Joseph and Benjamin, the last two. Okay. So tribes are not simply intermingled together. They are unique identifiers. So how can it be then that this man Mordechai is an Ish Yehudi, he is described as a man of Judah, at the same time we're told he's an Ish Yemini, a man of Benjamin? Okay, one could say, well, maybe on mom's side he was one, and on dad's side he was the other. Okay, but for tribal affiliation, we only go by dad, not by mom. That's why the Benot Slavchad, the daughters of Slavchad, in the absence of a brother, had to bring their case to Moses about whether they could inherit dad's Yerusha, his inheritance, whether it went to a woman in the absence of a man. So it's a big issue. So how do you reconcile a man of Judah and a man of Benjamin? Well, I'm glad you asked. So now we're going to go way back. Okay, how far? Biblical. Ready? So we know in the story of Joseph and the brothers. Joseph pretends to be Tzafnat Paneach, this vicious, diabolical, scheming Egyptian king who accuses the brothers of being meraglim, being spies. And they are forced to bring Benjamin back from the land of Canaan, the promised land of Israel, as proof that their story, that they are farmers, they're all related, and they are not spies, they have to bring Benjamin back. And you remember that when Benjamin comes, the story still continues, right? Joseph still does not identify himself, and he hides a goblet in the backpack of Benjamin, lets them leave, then chases after them and accuses Benjamin of being a ganav, of being a thief, and he's going to keep Benjamin forever as his slave. And the rest of you all, bye, go back to Jacob, have a nice life. Now Benjamin, according to Jacob, is the last remnant of his most beloved person in this world, Rachel. Rachel died giving birth to Benjamin. So the only two children left are Joseph and Benjamin. Unbeknownst to Jacob, to Yaakov, he thought Joseph is dead because the brothers dispatched him. Nobody knows that he's the king of Egypt. So if Joseph's out of the picture, the only genetic remnant of Jacob's Rachel is Benjamin. That's why he doesn't want to part with Benjamin. Judah guarantees the safety of Benjamin. He says, Dad, I promise to bring him back on my life. If I don't bring Benjamin back unharmed to you, I should lose my inheritance in this world and the next world. Anochi Erevan, the buck stops with me. President Truman literally quotes this, he used to be right on his desk. Buck stops with me. That's what it means to be a king. You accept responsibility. So what happens? When Benjamin, his life is in jeopardy, who steps up to face off with the king? Judah, of course, because he's the future king of the Jews. Remember we mentioned King Chizkiyahu, this great, wonderful king of Israel? He is the great-grandson of Judah, descended through King David and King Solomon, a great, very auspicious, fantastic line of kings, okay? Real nobility. Okay. So Judah faces off with Joseph over the life of who? Benjamin. Now remember, just file this away. How is the Megillah describing our Mordechai? As both a Judah guy and a Benjamin guy. Okay. At the end of the story, we all know it turns out well. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been the Broadway Andrew Lloyd Webber story, right? Joseph and the Technicolor Dreamcoat. We know it turns out well for everybody. Joseph reveals himself. I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? The brothers cry. They're reunited. All seems to be maybe well, but not really. There are undercurrents of jealousy and hostility. How do I know this? You ready for this? This is mind-bending. Because it's all there. Just listen to this. When Joseph reveals himself, Ani Yosef, the most heartrending two words in the entire Bible, I am Joseph. Benjamin cries. He's devastated. Benjamin's 30 years old. I just lost a lifetime with my brother Joseph because of cowardice and because of misunderstandings. And it's shattering. And the two brothers, both full brothers, remember, because they share both dad, Jacob, and mom, Rachel, they cry over each other. But the rabbi said they're not just crying for themselves. They're crying for the Jewish people. Why are they crying? Because they see somehow in some part of their mind, they get like a prophetic future little insight that all is not kosher for the Jews. It's going to end with the tabernacle and the temples being destroyed. Wow. And they're crying over the temples. Where were the temples located? Benjamin's territory was where the altar of the temple was located. So when Joseph cries over Benjamin, he's crying for the loss of Jerusalem, which is what? It's our story right here that we're learning about, because we're 70 years after the fall of Jerusalem by King Nebuchadnezzar. So it's full circle, but it's better than that. Listen to this. When Mordechai, a few chapters from now, leaves the royal palace after King Ahasuerus is blown away when he finds out that it was Mordechai who saved his life from the evil plot of the two would-be poisoners, the assassins, that happens early in the story. He, King Ahasuerus, never knew that it was Mordechai who saved his life. You know why he never knew? Because Haman hid it from him. The information was redacted, was sent out there in cyberspace. When Ahasuerus finds out that fateful night, that not only is Mordechai on his team, but that he saved him from assassination, he famously promotes Mordechai, and Mordechai is dressed in royal garbs. How many pieces of royal garb was he dressed in? Five. You know who else was dressed in five garments? Benjamin. Before Joseph sends Benjamin and his brothers back to the Promised Land to bring Jacob back to Egypt to live for 17 years together as a family, he gives all the brothers a change of clothes. But it says to Benjamin, Joseph gives five changes of clothes. What? So you're showing favoritism, Joseph, to your brother Benjamin, who is a son of Rachel, and a moment of rapprochement when you just got together with your brothers after the destruction of your life because of hostility between the brothers, and now you're showing open favoritism to brother Benjamin over the rest of the brothers? No. He's alluding to Mordechai. Because it was Mordechai who is uniquely given these five royal garments in the time of the story of Purim. But wait a minute. How is that a rapprochement? Because he's both Judah and Benjamin. The reason the text describes him as an Ish Yehudi and an Ish Yemini is because Mordechai himself is able to bridge the hostility and enmity, Jew versus Jew. And it was Mordechai who made a rapprochement between all of the Jewish people in the time of Ahasuerus and Haman. And because there is this coming together, La'yehudim ha'ita'ora v'simcha, that the Jews have this light and joy, because they all came together as one. Who brought them together? A son of Benjamin and a son of Judah. So was really Mordechai a son of Judah? Probably not. He was from the tribe of Benjamin. But why is he identified as a man from Judah? Because it was Judah who led the opposition to Joseph and Benjamin. And now the rapprochement comes with Mordechai, who's identified both as a tribal part of Judah and a tribal part of Benjamin at the same time, to show the coming together. That when we Jews can live together, Shevet Achim Gam Yachad, tribes living as one, the way Moses and Aaron and Moses lived together with love and not hostility and not competition, that will be the coming of Mashiach. We have yet, Ad Hayom Hazeh, to this day, we have never successfully navigated as Jews an ability to put aside partisan hostilities and enmities in past. Look at Israel. Israel is the most magical place in the world. And I'm sad to say that you know when Israel comes together? When the Arabs are about to murder us all. It's true. It's such a tragedy. When there's a war in Israel, when there's an act of terrorism in Israel, and when three young Jewish students, yeshiva students, are taken from Hamas, and they were murdered, Israel went to war in Gaza over those three young men. Nobody said, oh gee, what tribe did they come from? Are they Sephardic? Are they Ashkenazic? Are they religious? Are they not religious? They're me. They're our boys. Our boys come back. So it's such a tragedy that in the time of Esther, when we read this Megillah, we have to do better. You know, that's why on Purim, what are we all about on Purim? We dress up. We get together. We give gifts to each other. Sholach manos. The hamatash are going crazy to your friends. And then you're worried about the lesser people. The matanot levyonim. You're giving charity to the needy. We're thinking about every Jew is the same. This is the story of Purim. This is the success. So in other words, when Joseph is giving those five changes of clothes to Benjamin, he is already directly alluding to this moment in time when Mordechai, his, the great-great-great-great-great-grandson of Benjamin, is going to come out triumphantly, and all the Jews of Shushan are going to come together as one. And that will be a moment in the future, but not at that moment when he lived. So sadly, Joseph never saw that rapprochement in his lifetime. But he was alluding to it at this moment. So I just wanted to share that with you. And we'll end with that tonight as a sign of hope. I truly believe, bottom line about our story here about Purim, that it was the coming together of the Jews of Shushan, putting aside all their differences and looking at what they share, not what they don't share. And we all know that this is true. As a little boy, I'll never forget. I'm embarrassed to say that I was in an Orthodox synagogue, but I'll share it with you. So I'm a little boy. I come downstairs in the Orthodox temple, Shar Tzedek, where I grew up in Vancouver. Rabbi Marvin Heyer from the Wiesenthal Center was our rabbi. And I'm kind of like stunned because there's like three or four men. You know what they're doing? They're listening to the radio. I'm sure today they would have had their smartphones out. And I'm in shul, and it's Yom Kippur. So I'm looking, and you guys are listening to the radio. Like, what, you're listening to the ball game? You're in an Orthodox temple downstairs. I understand you're not in the synagogue proper, but you're downstairs listening to a radio? Of course, what were they listening to?
Ball game.
Yom Kippur War, 1973. We were shattered. We almost lost Israel in 1973. So these men, I didn't know what they were really up to, but they were listening to the reports clearly on the radio of the disaster, how the Arabs all attacked Israel in 1973. So again, if we in times of peace could just learn to put aside the differences, and that's why I love living in Wilkes-Barre, because I can honestly tell you that in Wilkes-Barre, Kingston, we get along. We don't worry about each other. You know, this is the only place that I know of personally ever that I've ever been to where the Orthodox and the Conservative and the Reform, we can share classes together, we share funerals together. Nobody's bickering and looking the other way. We don't judge. And I think it's one of the great things about our community. God should continue to bless us for this communal feeling. And we should emulate Mordechai as a combination of the Judah, the Benjamin, the coming together. Next week, we're going to continue, of course, with the Megillah.